Humane Society Wildlife Land Trust offers a humane solution, working with private landowners to protect habitat as permanent safe havens for wildlife. When you hear the familiar wild voices you love, remember, your voice is the one that can speak for wildlife and for the land they call home, ensuring that it stays forever wild. To learn more, to work with the Humane Society Wildlife Land Trust, visit wildlifelandtrust.org.
You're listening to Kingston's only campus community radio station, broadcasting 24/7, 365 on 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca. Tune in for the best local programming.
Good evening, it is 5 p.m. and this is Today in YGK on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. Today in YGK is brought to you by CFRC's News Collective, Christina Laurie, Jesse Bell, and Ellie Sturton. CFRC's news programming is made possible by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and the Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and here are your local news headlines. A $1 million fundraising pledge from the annual Rose of Hope Ladies Golf Tournament has made it possible to fund a new clinical chair position at Kingston Health Sciences Center. After raising $3.5 million over its 27-year history in support of women's health at KHSC, this year's tournament set its sights on a new, ambitious goal: establishing the Rose of Hope Clinical Chair in Breast Health at Kingston Health Sciences Center. KHSC has announced that Dr. Doris Jabs will be taking on this new leadership role. A women's imaging radiologist with more than two decades of experience, Dr. Jabs is also the longtime regional breast imaging lead for the Ontario Breast Screening Program and one of the driving forces behind the creation of KHSC's Breast Imaging Kingston, BIC, a state-of-the-art breast cancer screening and diagnostic facility. Dr. Jabs sat down with CFRC to share what this appointment means for her and the future of breast health in Kingston.
So the Rose of Hope Clinical Chair in Breast Health is truly, it's an inaugural position, and it really is an honor for me to be in this role. I've been in Kingston as a breast radiologist for, I don't want to give away my age, but I'm moving on to my end of my second decade. And breast imaging truly is a passion for me. I enjoy every day going to work. I enjoy my work. I enjoy the people I work with, and I enjoy the people that I am providing a service to. This position is very special. So this position moves us from the excellent technology that we have, the amazing facility at Breast Imaging Kingston, which if you haven't been to, you really should at least zip by to see how special it is, to a more transformative position, which is now going to bring all that technology together with the expertise that we have in the city, which is excellent across multiple disciplines. So we have expertise in primary care, family physicians, in imaging, breast radiology, oncology, surgery, pathology. And this position now is going to marry all that together, or attempt to marry all that together, and find gaps that we can close in innovative ways, thinking out of the box, in a real patient-centered or client-centered approach. So this is going to be all about the women, the people that we serve. It's going to be about making their journey quicker, simpler, hopefully less anxiety-laden together.
According to KHSC, unlike funding for a single piece of equipment, a clinical chair position provides the time and resources for a physician to drive innovation in care, research, and education. Dr. Jabs explained the transformative power of a clinical chair role and some of her goals walking into the position.
So a clinical chair, I believe the other position that we have is in genomics. The clinical chair is very different. So the way the system currently works is we have all these specialties that do have heads of department and heads of sections, and they're all excellent in and of their own right. The surgeons are excellent, the pathologists are excellent, the radiologists, the primary care, they're all very good, but it's a bit siloed. from a patient perspective, in any case, I think it's a bit siloed. And so although everybody is doing excellent work in their area, you need somebody or something or a role to be able to tie that all together, right, for the people that experience the care. So we as care providers are excellent care providers in our area, but the people that we care for actually move within all those different areas. And so it's to bring all of that together. And that is a very unique role that we currently have at KGH. It is very forward thinking. I'm very excited to be in this position.
And what kinds of innovation are you looking to explore? What are you excited about?
I can't give away all of my secrets, of course, right? it's going to be iterative. So I certainly have some ideas already that we're rolling out that we're going to try and bring sort of some that we can do very quickly, others that will take a little bit longer. I think one of the most important things is I'm really keen on getting a rapid access type service going at the BIC. So this can be done in many different ways, but basically it's a way to have women be seen quicker in a seamless way. We definitely are going to be updating ourselves and bringing in all the new technologies that we have. We have AI platforms, we have digital technologies, we have social media, we have all these innovative technological tools available that I think have been perhaps maybe a little bit underused. So I'm certainly going to try and bring some of those in. We have to reach out to our underserved communities. That is a definite gap that we need to address. And so those are sort of some of our initial initiatives.
Yeah. And I mean, you kind of dove into this right there, but I was wondering if you could speak to some of the challenges that we're facing in breast health and those first things that you're really wanting to address when you walk into this position.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is just my personal experience and what I've gleaned over my years of working in the field. I think some of the barriers that we have in breast health is there's some fear around it. Certainly, there are some groups that are very keen on getting screened and keen on their breast health. There are others that don't know. So education is a huge gap that we need to fill. People may just not know about what they need to do for their breast health. And then there are others, I think, that are anxious and have fears which may have a foundation, fears which may not be grounded. And so I think those are all barriers to getting screened, to being an advocate for your breast health, to getting things done. And so we need to really increase our screen participation rate in the region. That's the key thing in breast health, right? It's all about breast screening. It's all about detection. And the OBSP, the Ontario Breast Screening Program, which is our provincial breast screening program, has recently dropped the age of screen. So historically, women from the age of 50 to 72 were invited to the breast screening program, and we've now dropped that to 40. So I think there's a huge group of people out there that we could now access that may or may not even know that this is what's available for them. So it's sort of trying to take away the fear a little bit, to decrease the anxiety through education and absolutely through accessibility.
This year's Rose of Hope tournament raised $285,000, the first installment of their five-year pledge.
The Rose of Hope is very special. They are a very energizing and inspiring group of women. Although I've been aware of the Rose of Hope and we've had them support multiple technologies at the BIC, our MRI is coming online early 2026. They were fundamental in other technologies at the BIC to include our prone biopsy table and prone biopsy device. So they're not new to me. I'm not new to them. But the Rose of Hope tournament this year, which was all about this clinical chair position and their fundraising for that, was truly humbling, inspiring, energizing all at the same time. These women are a very dedicated group of women to truly improve the care that the women in our region are receiving. It's fantastic.
According to the Rochester Institute of Technology, more than 22 million pounds of plastic pollution end up in the Great Lakes every year, the very same lakes that provide drinking water for more than 40 million Canadians and Americans. This September, Kingston will be one of six Ontario communities taking part in the province's first ever Great Lakes Coastal Cleanup. The event is organized by the Great Lakes and St. Lawrence Cities Initiative, a coalition representing communities in the Great Lakes and St. Lawrence River region. The organization secured $85,000 in provincial funding to support the shoreline cleanups taking place in Thunder Bay, Chatham-Kent, Owen Sound, Collingwood, Cobourg, and Kingston. On World Rivers Day, September 28th, volunteers across Ontario will gather with the goal of collecting up to 440 pounds of litter along beaches, parks, and waterfronts. Mayor Brian Patterson spoke with CFRC regarding Kingston's part in the project.
Yeah, I think it's actually a really exciting initiative. You know, when I think about all the characteristics and all the things that make Kingston, Kingston, you know, there's lots of things that I can think of, but one of, I think, the most important treasures that we have is our waterfront. And it's something that, you know, people just are naturally drawn to our waterfront. There's so many amazing places to enjoy. We've invested a lot as a city in different places and public spaces where people can go and appreciate and enjoy the waterfront. And so I think that really this event is about, you know, capturing our community's imagination and in terms of making sure with stewardship that we're taking care of that waterfront, we're preserving it, and making sure that it continues to be just an amazing part of our city.
Local organizations and businesses have been stepping up to ensure the day will be a success.
What's been exciting is the number of local partner organizations that are really kind of going to be on the ground doing the work, whether it's Sustainable Kingston, you have Ahoy Rentals that's making, basically offering free kayaks for people that want to go along the shoreline and help clean up. We've also got our amazing diving community. They're going to be doing some of the in-water cleanup. We've got Rotary. We've got a number of different organizations that are that have agreed and are happy to sign up. And so that was really inspiring, right? I mean, we have Swim Drink Fish, which is another great organization that's really big into stewardship of clean water. And so, you know, I think it really has hit a nerve with a lot of people and a lot of organizations. And so I think we're going to have a small army there on September the 28th. It'll be exciting to see.
While the project is starting with one-time provincial funding, Patterson says the momentum could encourage more initiatives like this in the future.
I think anything is possible. I think given the momentum that we've seen, I think there's absolutely opportunities to continue to do events like this. And in the past, there have even been a number of local groups that have gone out and of their own initiative have done what they can to clean up the clean up our shoreline and to do what they can to beautify our waterfront. So I think given that goal, I think there's always going to be community level interest, whether it will be under this umbrella or maybe just something else. I mean, we'll see how things evolve. But I think that, you know, this is a really great opportunity. And obviously, we've been granted some one-time funding from the province. So we want to take advantage and do as best we can. If there's interest in continued partnership in future years, of course, we're more than happy to explore that.
Residents can find more information on the initiative at glslcities.org.
You know, everyone in our community understands the importance of sustainability and environmental stewardship, doing what we can as a community. But this is one of those tangible things that I think, you know, you can really see the impact of right away. I've already been incredibly impressed by the response that we've gotten from the community on this. There's going to be lots of interest that's going to continue to grow and to build towards cleanup day on the 28th and of September. And so I'm excited, you know, really get a chance that, you know, if this is important to you, you can make a real difference right here in Kingston.
Kingston Health Sciences Center is officially the first hospital in Canada to implement a groundbreaking artificial intelligence tool used to diagnose coronary artery disease. Coronary artery disease is the most common form of cardiovascular disease and the leading cause of death worldwide. It occurs when the coronary arteries become narrowed or blocked, reducing blood flow to the heart. Thanks to a $100,000 donation from local donor Steven Sorensen, KHSC has introduced HeartFlow, a revolutionary AI-based technology that's transforming cardiac care. HeartFlow enables radiologists and cardiologists to measure blood flow through a patient's coronary arteries using a non-invasive CT scan. Dr. Omar Islam, head of diagnostic radiology at KHSC, explained what the diagnostic process for coronary artery disease has looked like until now.
Patients with stable chest pain typically undergo a CT scan of their heart to look at the coronary arteries, which are the blood vessels that supply oxygen and glucose to the heart muscle. And a narrowing of those blood vessels, especially severe narrowing of those blood vessels, can be significant and may be a precursor to that patient having a heart attack in the future. So those patients are typically triaged by a coronary CT angiogram to look at those blood vessels, and it's a dye that's injected into the veins, and we get a 3D map of the blood vessels. So that's how it's done. And then those patients, if they have severe narrowing on the coronary CTA, are referred potentially on to the cath lab, so the angio suite. So undergo a minor surgical procedure where that narrowing is confirmed. And if the narrowing is confirmed, then a blood flow analysis is performed, looking at the reduction in blood flow through those vessels. And reduction in blood flow is actually the most important determinant of the risk of having a heart attack. So if the blood flow is reduced, that means there's reduced delivery of oxygen and glucose to the heart muscle, and then that patient is at risk for a heart attack. So it's not really the narrowing that's most important, it's the reduction in blood flow. So we cannot assess in a typical situation the blood flow on CT. We can only assess the narrowing of the blood vessel. And so those patients typically have to be sent to the cath lab for the minor surgical procedure to look at blood flow.
Now, using the AI capabilities of HeartFlow, physicians can measure blood flow directly from a CT scan. If the flow is normal, the patient avoids an invasive procedure entirely.
Yeah, so HeartFlow is a really cool new technology. So it's a non-invasive technology that uses those CT scan images and it extrapolates blood flow from the narrowing in those blood vessels. So in essence, it gives the doctor the same information that they would otherwise need to get from the cath lab doing that minor surgical procedure. And now we get that information non-invasively from the CT scan images themselves. So it really is a one-stop shop for assessment of the coronary arteries and risk of heart disease and strokes.
For patients, this means faster answers and better care with less risk.
It's beneficial for the patients in many ways. First of all, it's non-invasive. So a cath lab is a minor surgical procedure, and patients have to come into the hospital for day surgery, and they have to have a puncture in their groin vessels or in their arm vessels, and they have to have dye and have pictures of their heart taken under radiation. And so, these procedures are performed every day throughout the country. They're extremely safe, but there's still a very small risk of complications such as bleeding or stroke. And of course, no one wants to undergo an invasive procedure if they don't have to. So in, up to 30% of patients, heart flow analysis avoids that patient from having to undergo that invasive angio procedure. Also, because the heart flow is applied when the patient has their CAT scan, they get the answer, the diagnosis, within a few minutes to a few hours, rather than having to wait weeks or days for the catheter procedure to occur. So they get an answer immediately. And because they get that answer right away, they can potentially get started on treatment and medications right after their CT scan with heart flow, rather than having to wait until after the results of the cath lab. Furthermore, there's less, obviously, radiation and contrast dye exposure because they're only getting a CT scan. They're not getting an angio procedure in the cath lab, so they avoid radiation and contrast dye. This is especially useful in some elderly patients or other patients who have diabetes and kidney disease, where the risk of kidney malfunction is higher with repeated contrast dye exposure. So in those patients, this test is very useful because we don't have to give the patients contrast dye twice.
This technology is also a game changer for healthcare providers and the healthcare system.
This is really, really an amazing tool from the healthcare efficiency perspective. The fact that the heart flow triages the right patients to go onwards to cath lab is really important because it reduces hospital admissions and procedure backlogs in the cath lab. There's, you know, we have long wait lists everywhere in our healthcare system. So by triaging the right patient to undergo the right test, this saves time and, of course, avoids patients from having to undergo these unnecessary procedures. Therefore, the time in the cath lab can be directed to patients who actually need to be there. You know, it's also leads to better outcomes because of timely treatment for those who need it. And for those who don't need the procedure, HeartFlow provides the reassurance that their blood flow is not reduced and is not significant, and therefore they don't need to go on to further testing.
HeartFlow is now fully operational at KHSC.
So far, so good. You know, we plan on collecting data from all the patients who undergo cardiac CT and HeartFlow analysis. We expect approximately 100 patients over the next 12 months to undergo the HeartFlow analysis. So we'll have a lot more information, you know, coming up in the next year.
Teams at KHSC will be studying the technology's effectiveness in Canadian patients, with the goal of publishing their findings and inspiring adoption in hospitals across the country.
This technology, although it is new, it is a game changer. It works. It's been validated across multiple centers in the United States and Europe. We are fortunate to be the first site in Canada, all of Canada, to be using it. But we do hope that, you know, our use provides recognition and is newsworthy enough so that government officials, including Ministry of Health in Ontario, take notice and realize the value in, you know, not just for individual patients, but for the healthcare system in implementation of this technology broadly across all sites in Ontario. You know, we do feel that there's a big role for artificial intelligence in the healthcare system to work alongside the physicians, the administrators, and the staff to increase efficiencies, provide more accurate diagnosis, faster diagnosis, and improve the quality of care. We see AI as a tool that augments the care that we can provide to our patients.
That wraps up your headlines for this evening. Next up is Jesse Bell with your weather and traffic report for this evening.
This is your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Monday, September 1st, a beautiful 25-degree day here in the city of Kingston with a lot of bright sunshine. Tuesday, September 2nd, slightly cooler at 23, but still a stunning late summer, early fall day. Wednesday, September 3rd, we are going to see a daytime high of 24 degrees with plenty of bright sunshine. Thursday, September 4th, the first non-sunny day in the forecast, daytime high of 21 degrees with a 64% chance of precipitation, a lot of wind and a lot of rain predicted for Thursday. Moving into Friday, we get the remnants of that Thursday rainy day with a daytime high of 18 degrees. A couple of rain clouds here and there, but largely it's going to be a beautiful day here in the city of Kingston, just in time for the Queens game against the Laurier Golden Hawks under the lights at Richardson Stadium. Moving into the first weekend of September, Saturday, September 6th, daytime high of 17 with about a 50% chance of rain, and Sunday, September 7th, 17 degrees as well, but with lots of bright sunshine. And then moving into the start of next week, Monday, September 8th, 17 degrees and sunny. This is Jesse Bell with your City of Kingston traffic report. We begin with road closures. Aberdeen Street, William 2 Johnson is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging. Albert Street, Princess to Mac, closed to accommodate construction activity and staging at 484 Albert Street. Berry Street, Queen to Colborne, closed for construction-related activity at 283 Queen Street. Cranbrook Street, Lakeview to Days, is closed on school days from 8:40 a.m. to 9:20 a.m. and 3:20 p.m. to 3:50 p.m. for a school street at Our Lady of Lourdes Catholic School. Demare Avenue, Taylor Kidd to Wheat Hill, is closed September 2nd from 7 a.m. to 5 p.m. for a paving operation. Earl Street, Collingwood to Toronto, is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work.
King Street, the tragically hip way to Place d'Armes, is closed September 4th from 4 to 7:30 p.m. for the Kingston Frontenac's annual season ticket holder barbecue. Kings Court Avenue, concession to First, is closed September 2nd to October 10th for a gas main installation. Lincoln Drive at Bay Ridge, closed until September 19th for the construction of new active transportation infrastructure. Sydenham Street, Princess to Queen, closed until October 3rd for the Sydenham Street community space. Victoria Street, Union to Johnson, closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. Wheat Hill Street, Demare to Gerald Hunt Memorial Park, closed September 2nd from 7 a.m. to 5 p.m. for a paving operation. And Woodburn Road, Hitchcock to Whitechurch, is closed for a contractor to complete culvert relining. Here are some other delays to be aware of. Bay Ridge Drive, Milford to Henderson, expect delays for the construction of new active transportation infrastructure and intersection upgrades. Catwoods Drive, Centennial to Gardeners, expect delays for the construction of a new multi-use pathway. Front Road, San Beta Country Club, expect delays for the installation of sanitary and water main for Utilities Kingston. Traffic will be reduced to one lane in each direction. Gardeners Road at Centennial and Creekford, expect delays while a contractor completes intersection widening, traffic signal upgrades, and cycling and pedestrian improvements. Highway 2, Abbeydon to St. Lawrence, expect delays to complete enhanced flood protection of Abbeydon Road, Highway 2 and St. Lawrence Avenue. Highway 15, Kingston Mills to Middle, expect delays for a contractor to complete work on the Highway 15 CNR overhead construction. John Marks Avenue and Innovation Drive, expect delays while a contractor mobilizes to start work on John Marks Avenue, Innovation Drive, and Discovery Avenue. Work includes curb, sidewalk, asphalt milling, and repaving. Lancaster Drive, Limestone to Jasper, expect delays while a contractor completes construction of a new sidewalk and road improvements. Montreal Street at John Counter, expect delays for upgrades to the intersection, including new lighting, traffic signals, lanes, paving, and signage to improve safety and efficiency for all road users. And Victoria Street and Earl Street, expect delays while a contractor mobilizes to site to start work on the second phase of reconstruction of sewer, water main, sidewalks, and road.
Thank you for tuning in to CFRC's local news programming. To revisit episodes of Today in YGK and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Today in YGK is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What Will I Wear, 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
What'll I Wear offers the best in vintage, funky, one-of-a-kind treasures, clothing, accessories, and a fabulous selection of jewels, vintage and new. Find the cutest purse, the most dashing of hats and sunglasses, everything to complete your individual look. What'll I Wear has it all. They can dress you from top to bottom. Find your new fashion fave at What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street in Kingston. Visit their new location and follow them on Facebook to keep up to date with what's in store at What'll I Wear. Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present a selection from the winter in Canada's long-anticipated new yet untitled album. Over the summer, the band gave us a taste of what was yet to come with singles like Wolves, Tides, and Threads, each one marked with the band's signature aggressive downbeats and roaring guitars and bass. Now the full album is here, delivering that same raw energy across an unrelenting track list. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visit kingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream Untitled by The Winter in Canada on your favorite platforms and enjoy a selection from it called The Head, the Tail, the Wings, and the Claws with us now, right here on CFRC 101.9 FM.
I said blue. Good day. You're listening to Free City Radio. This is edition 280, and I'm Stefan Christoph. Thanks for tuning in. On the broadcast this week, I'm going to be featuring a conversation with educator and longtime activist Rabab Abdel Hadi. Rabab has been an important Palestinian voice working to raise the profile of the Palestine Solidarity Movement and the struggle of the Palestinian people for human rights, for justice, for dignity for many years. Rabab has been very active in organizing with educators and students in the context of California and beyond over the last years, and I thought it would be important to highlight Rabab's voice. I speak with her about the connections between the Palestine movement for justice and other struggles all around the world, looking at the connections between the local and the global. I think this is an important and wide-ranging interview with a voice that has faced a lot of pressure to be silent in the context of the United States, but has resisted and opposed that. So it's really a pleasure to feature this conversation with Rabab Abdel Hadi on Free City Radio. Here it is. There's been a significant crackdown by U.S. authorities, the suppression of Palestinian voices at academic institutions. Often this is talked about in a way that I think removes a lot of the agency from Palestine solidarity movements and university-based organizing for justice in Palestine, in the sense that this space has really moved the conversation, has really played a huge role in lifting up both the reality in Gaza today, but also more generally the whole Palestinian history. So I think that that's an important part that's often left out of the conversation of this repression, is how these movements have a lot of agency and have created a huge amount of political space to talk about Palestine. You've been part of that. So maybe if you could just introduce yourself and share any thoughts you have about this particular point. Thank you so much.
Yes, first of all, let me talk about the context in the U.S. The U.S. has definitely been, there is a rising repression that we have witnessed escalating. And it is, although it has magnified and multiplied since the arrival of Trump in the U.S. Government, it is not something that has just started with Trump. I think it's really important to understand like a few things. One, that it's been cumulative. So Trump came and actually escalated and fulfilled his promises, what he promised during his campaign and what he said in his inauguration speech, and also what his various people in his government, what the right in the United States has already said. Also, this is continuation of the repression for history of the United States. Not only the history, which we can even start from the early 20th century with the expulsion and deportation of the communists, of the anarchists, of all the values, but also since the 18th century, the law of 1798 of enemy alien, rounding up people, expelling them outside the country. We talk about the attack against the communists in the 30s and the 40s, the escalation, the World War II of rounding up Japanese people, putting them in concentration camp, which is according to the enemy alien during the Second World War, there was a McCarthyism. After there was a McCarran-Walter Act was used against communists. It was also used against Jews, some Jews who were coming out of Europe and so on. And it escalated against communism to the point that it attacked everybody. And what we are seeing today, I'm calling it new McCarthyism. And it escalated more in the 60s. It was attacks also escalated against also people who are known to be leftists, McCarthyists, radicals, against SDS. And the Weather Underground, and against also COINTELPRO, against all the movements of Black Panthers, American Indian movement. And we are seeing in the 70s and the 80s, it was also rising up against specifically anti-colonial national national liberation movements. The Palestinians were specifically targeted because now the U.S. is also, what we say, quote, foreign policy of the U.S., now specifically targeting people because the U.S. now is seeing that its policy is shifting from being involved in Vietnam because now there is a split in the ruling class in the U.S. That part of it is saying we shouldn't stay in Vietnam. Our economic interests, our imperialist interests, and so on, it's not really good for us. We need to actually move out of Vietnam. Also, there is a huge movement in the U.S. against the involvement in the war and the world, of course. Okay, but then now that there is a movement, now they're saying let's move to the region, the Arab Southwest Asia, North Africa, and let's go there. And now it is very important to target whoever are against Israel in the region. So now the whole question focusing on what they label as terrorism and focusing on the, and this keeps recurring. So now we're seeing much more of that. Not collapse, but I say there is a meeting of interest by the pro-Israel, the Zionist movement, that is also very right-wing, that's engaged with Jewish supremacy, with white supremacy, with the interest, the socio-economic and political economic interest, because it's not, when people say it's hate, it is not individual hate. It's about supremacy. One people see themselves as better than other people, and they see Palestinians and others as inferior to them. So then we come to this, and that's part of it. But there is the genocide against the Palestinians, taking majorly concentrating in Gaza, and now definitely has been spreading to the West Bank and expelling people and so on. And there is what's going on in the United States, crushing and repressing and attacking everybody. So now there is targeting immigrants, and which is really odd because Trump says, for example, we're an occupied country, and it's really weird given that the United States is actually a settler colonial state that settlers have occupied the land of the indigenous people. So what do you mean you're occupied? But it does get understood when you think about the United States. Trump is actually expressing solidarity with the white settlers of South Africa and saying that they are their rights are. I mean, all of it is sort of mixed upside down, and it needs somebody to unpack. So now we come to the whole question of the attack. So for us, it's been going on. I mean, and me, it's been going on for a very long time, and it's very institutionalized. And I want to say, yes, it's been targeting me. Part of it is because I'm outspoken. I speak up for Palestine, for Palestinian rights. I speak up against the erasure of Palestine, erasure of Palestinian resistance to Zionist genocide. I teach about it. I'm building a program that is being institutionalized in the curriculum. And big part of the Zionist agenda is to criminalize Palestine, general, stop the narrative of Palestine, stop anybody speaking about Palestine at all, because that undermines the Zionist narrative that presents Israel the land of milk and honey. And also they don't want it to be institutionalized in the curriculum, because once it is part of the curriculum, it means that everybody can learn about it in the classes and so on. It's not just something that you can come and go. I think also today it's a very, very interesting moment, because it shows that the repression is rising more and more and more, because there is a contestation of public space. They're unable to control the public space through hegemony. So they bring in the troops. That's the only way we can explain why the repression is rising so much. I mean, we can go back to explain what's my situation, but I think we need to understand it in such a structural, bigger issues, rather than just like only what's happening here, what's happening there. Okay, so I'll stop here. Yeah.
Well, you made a line and drew connections, between different points in history. Around both social movement organizing, anti-colonial struggles, and sort of the entire question of land and territory and colonization, which is, central to the power structure of the United States and, of course, to the Israeli state project. We won't have time to get into all the different points you addressed, but I've just encouraged people to resonate with quite a few of the examples that you highlighted. Maybe I'll ask you just to sort of build on what you described around the importance of sort of understanding connections between different movements across time, and also sort of not allowing power to isolate. Like a moment like today is often sort of presented as, you know, a sort of an individualized moment or sort of a point in history without the continuum. So maybe an interesting example to think about that is thinking about the contestation of public space that you underlined, which I agree with you is so important, and how that actually has that contestation of public space has a lineage, right? And if we can maybe just look back to other movements, maybe two examples are the movement against the U.S. Occupation and invasion of Vietnam, but also the student movement, let's say, in Jordan and in Lebanon in the late 1960s that mirrored a lot of ways or is connected to, maybe is a better way of describing it, a global moment, right? And that student movement is not given as much focus, given that it's outside the West. But, you know, the buildup in the late 60s and the early 70s in Lebanon, for example, was very important.
Yes. And actually, maybe even we can go a little bit earlier, too. So let's talk about one at a time. I mean, the Vietnam, there is a draft, and the students, little by little, first of all, youth, are refusing to go to serve. Little by little, consciousness is rising. And then you talked about individualize. And here, we do need to talk about the roles of individuals like Muhammad Ali, who sacrifices the most important moment of his career. I mean, he basically, his career gets shut down as the world champion of boxing. And he sacrifices, and he said, I am not going to go fight Vietnamese people. Nobody has ever called me the N-word. And part of it, and I think it's really important, this is part of the analysis, we don't generally, as peace movement, anti-colonial movement, talk about, which is the fact that he became a Muslim, and his Muslimness, and his being mentored by Malcolm X, who will become, we celebrate his 100th birthday if he wasn't assassinated next week, you know, May 19th. This is a very important also element in this, his ideological development, in his political development, in him seeing what the United States as a settler colony is all about, identifying. So he says, I'm not going to go fight. And also many youth are saying, I'm not going to go fight. Why should I also go fight? So they begin, there is a movement, and many of it begins on students, but it's also many people who are drafted who are saying, I'm not going to go fight. And it coincides also with the rise of the Black Panther Party, the Young Lord Party, the American Indian Party. There is a huge Chicano moratorium. I mean, there is movements around the Students for Democratic Society. I mean, everywhere there's, we're not. And there is definitely contestation of space. And this is why, like last week on Monday was the anniversary of the Kent State, when the troops go in and actually shoot for students and kill them. So we're talking about that when people say this is the first time. No, this is not the first time. Now we're saying that it is ungovernable. There is something wrong from the point of view of the elites, and they go in and they basically and really the student, and then say the whole thing is that the students and the youth and everybody is saying there is something wrong. Business as usual cannot continue being business as usual. And I think this is very important, and it's happening everywhere. And the Vietnamese, whose victory we just celebrated April 30th, 50th anniversary, they do say that it is, and we take a note from them as Palestinians, that it was the resistance, the fierce and heroic resistance of the Vietnamese people against the U.S. invasion, as the smallest country of the world with huge sacrifice, 3 million martyrs, against the biggest power, and the solidarity movement, the anti-war movement, that made it impossible for the U.S. to continue until Nixon had to end the draft. It ended up with the victory of the Vietnamese on the ground, and the victory of the movement in the U.S. We talk about the movements in the there is movements that go on. We can also even start for Palestine and so on, Palestine and Jordan, because it was annexed, unfortunately, in 1950. There is movements when all these democratic governments get elected, like Sliman Nabilsi in 1958, and there are movements all over, and the king outs the democratic movement, and one young Palestinian, Raja Abu Amasha, gets killed when there are protests or the movement. In Lebanon, there are strikes, and the Marines, U.S. Marines, get involved. And the history here completely, people are completely unaware. You go to the 60s, there are movements for liberation in Yemen. There are movements for liberation in Oman and Dhofar and Bahrain. There are moves everywhere in the Arab world, in America, in Beirut. There are all the universities are out protesting, and there is a long history. We don't have time to go into it. But there is so many organizations, so many movements, and people think only of some moments because they remember some figures. But there is movements again and again and again, some specific to the Palestinian students movement, some known everywhere else. But there are, and there is, the movements are very much connected. And this is like we talk about today, there is students movement on campuses. And in Iran, how many students participate? And then you also talk about Mexico, students at the University of Mexico that Claudia Sheinbaum just apologized for, like a few months ago, and said, we're really sorry because the army went in and killed students on October 2nd, 1968, that here people talk about the 60s, but they don't recognize that there were other 68s in the world.
What you're outlining makes me think about all the learning that happened within the Gaza Solidarity encampments. And, you know, I think about the late scholar Aziz Chaudhry, who talked a lot about learning within social movements and how spaces of protest and occupations, you know, land-based protests where you actually have a little territory where you've held space are really important intersections where learning happens about all these connected points in history. Do you have any reflections, you know, and I know you're focused a lot on teaching and education, about how social movements are a critically important space for learning?
Yes, I definitely agree, and we totally miss Aziz and his presence among us. He was an amazing teacher and scholar, and but definitely land-based, because you do need a place, you need grounded space. And I could think about the indigenous people. I could think about like Zapatista, for example, the various American Indian movement, Wounded Knee. Leonard Peltier has just been freed. I think about the Palestinians in various places, though, but also think the encampment on campuses, that students build the encampment and end the encampment themselves. They're learning, they're showing. I mean, last night, our students at my own university, San Francisco State University, showed the documentary encampment. They're on hunger strike. They showed the encampment and they had a discussion about it. So part of the process of protesting is also learning. And I think it's really important. They are actually acting what social movements are all about. Social movements are not just about protesting, sitting about and saying we are protesting. So in the social movement, there has to be thinking, there has to be strategizing, there has to be figuring out what are the best tactics for any particular time. Last year, it was all encampments, the university authorities, the neoliberal, the corporatized universities, which are collaborating with the government, you know, policies and the policing and so on, decided that they're going to crush that. And they thought that in the summer, they sent all the disciplinary measures and they punished students when the commencement happened and there is nobody on campuses anymore. And they thought the students will go away. The students came back and took over halls and named them after Palestinian martyrs, and in the process educated. So like last year, it was Colombia named Hind Hall, about Hind Rajab. In USF, it was after Shabbat, the journalist. So in the process, even when they name it, people will say, who's this person? And you learn about what happened to them, how they were martyred and so on. But I think also, so now all the takeover is they already know, because once you have a tactic, the repressive forces learn how to, we learn, and they learn how to do it, how to repress it, how to take care of it, and so on. You can't continue doing it anymore. And the students have been for a while trying to figure out what to do with all these repressive measures, with kidnapping students of the street, putting them ice, moving them from one state after another, even though judges are saying you cannot do that. And then now all of a sudden the students are coming up with a new tactic, the hunger strike. And it's very interesting, for example, there's Israel in solidarity with Palestine, and it's very interesting the connection, even the symbolism of connecting encampment with the refugee camps, saying we are in solidarity with people who've been displaced, uprooted from their land, are in camps, and we are in solidarity with them. So even the choices of the symbols and so on are very conscious. There is consciousness in it, and there is every single thing they are choosing. There is a very conscious social movement, and there is goals also. This is what we want. In order for us to do this, we want, and there are goals that are short-term achievable goals. Of course, the system is refusing to achieve that, but they continue. And then they, of course, not necessarily they're going to win every battle, because the system is very strong, very equipped. They exchange with each other. They call in on different forces. They bring the police, the state troopers. I mean, they have no qualms. The university's sacred space is not sacred for them. Even the whole question that trespassing, how could you be trespassing on your own university? And why would you even call the university that you own it? I mean, you don't own it, either private university or public university. This whole question of trespassing, not only to mention that it is the whole question of private property, is very problematic. But even if you go by that, it doesn't belong to the administration. It belongs to everybody on the campus. Why would one body take over to this? So you're assigning yourself as the judge, the ruler, and the executor of the universe. I mean, this whole question of discipline, the question of being the gladiator, it's not acceptable. So the students and this is a very amazing social movement. And if you, and I like the way that you're doing it, comparing, because it's really important to think, and they're connecting. So the National Students for Justice in Palestine are connecting with students in Palestine. Last summer, when the San Francisco State University canceled my course on Palestine after they accepted, I launched it anyway online. Of course, the loss was I lost my salary. But we had, and they said, oh, there's going to be low enrollment. I had 566 people sign up for the course. And we did it with the students at Bir Zeit, we did it with Mondo Weiss, and we called it Open University for Palestine. Because we were inspired by the Students for Justice in Palestine. We were inspired by the Right to Education campaign at Bir Zeit and so on. And we're doing it open university. We're doing open classrooms. We're not charging people fees, because education is supposed to be free. And we are connecting with universities in Palestine. And we're expressing solidarity for all the universities in Gaza that have been completely destroyed, and the faculty who've been killed, and the students who've been martyred. So I think this dialectical relationship and this solidarity that's being built, and the rejection of what is the dichotomy of the foreign domestic, it is a very, very clear, very strong strategizing movement. It's a small movement, and it's the same thing with when you talk about Vietnam. The balance of forces is not in our favor, because they have the weapons, they have everything, but we're trying what we are doing, and every single time you're challenging them, and they're challenging them, and they know that they are unable to control, and that's why they're becoming nastier, and they're bringing in the troops more and more.
That was a conversation with Rabab Abdelhadi, an educator and long-term Palestinian community organizer based in California. Thanks so much to Rabab for joining the program this week. This has been another edition of Free City Radio. Thank you to the Social Justice Center at Concordia for your support. I'm Stefan Christoff. We air monthly on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal on Wednesdays at 11 a.m. On CJLO 1690 AM in Montreal on Wednesdays at 8 AM. On CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Tuesdays at 8 AM. On CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston on Wednesdays at 11:30 AM. On CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria on Saturdays at 7 AM. On Met Radio 1280 AM in Toronto on Fridays at 5:30 AM. On CKCU 93.1 FM in Ottawa on Tuesdays at 2 PM, and on CGSF 90.1 FM in Vancouver on Thursdays at 4:30 PM. You can find our archives at soundcloud.com/freecityradio. We are also podcasts. Look us up on your favorite podcast platform. I'm Stefan Christoff, and thanks for tuning in.